In April 2005, they received the official order. The Wisconsin Army National Guard's 2nd Battalion of the 127th Infantry was being mobilized. After training at Camp Shelby, Mississippi, the 620 soldiers of the Gator Battalion would serve in Operation Iraqi Freedom, providing armed convoy escort and route security throughout all of Iraq, from Umm Qasr in the south to Mosul in the far north. Their mission would take them into the most dangerous regions of Iraq during the next year, and the battalion would withstand hundreds of attacks, see dozens wounded, and lose three members killed in action. We read about their deployments, we read about them coming home, and sometimes we read about their deaths. But what's day-to-day life like for Wisconsin soldiers in Iraq? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
In this most high-tech of conflicts, what's the difference between the war in Iraq and previous wars fought by American troops? How does a war photographer choose the images to represent it? And what experiences are the most difficult to convey in pictures, or for that matter, in words? Well, we have two guests. They are Nathan Olson and Joseph Streeter, members of the Wisconsin Army National Guards, 2nd Battalion of the 127th Infantry. They're photographers. In the book Private Soldiers, A Year in Iraq with a Wisconsin National Guard Unit, published by the Wisconsin Historical Society Press in 2007.
Welcome to University of the Year.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is a beautiful book, you know, the images and all the different kinds of elements, letters and interviews with different people. I don't know that I've seen something quite like it, because it almost, when you first look at it, looks as if it's going to be a travel book, a tourist book, the way a National Geographic might take you on a vacation trip and show you the sights. Yet at the same time, it's got this other side that it is a record of war. I was also struck that you have the royalties going to help the family support groups and sort of the memorial funds for the three lost soldiers. I wonder if you could start each of you just by introducing who you are, what got you into the National Guard, and how you came to do the photographs for this. Joe?
I enlisted in the Army in 1995 into Charlie Company, 2127, where I've been for pretty much my entire career. I'm now an infantry squad leader in Charlie. Full-time, I work for the Guard, my civilian career. I'm an IT specialist, and I act as the system administrator for the state of Wisconsin. So I kind of have two worlds, the infantry side and the IT side. Grew up in Fond du Lac. That's kind of how I became part of Charlie Company up there, and now I live in Madison.
And what made you do the photographs for the book?
I did photography kind of on the side as a hobby. Took some cameras with me, and while we were conducting missions, I would shoot some photos along the way. And I was kind of building up quite a collection of photographs when Ben kind of came up with the book idea, and we started kind of put the two together, and before you know it, we've got ourselves a book.
Nathan?
I grew up in Nacoosa, and right after high school, I went in active army for a couple of years. And in the fall of 90, I got out of active army and joined the National Guard. And actually, at that time, I was in Ripon. Spent, 16 years now in the battalion, a couple different companies. They rearrange every couple of years. Worked my way up through the ranks. At some point in the last couple of years, I took a commission, became a lieutenant, and during the deployment, I was a platoon leader. So I had about 35 men underneath me in Charlie Company. So I was did the platoon thing during the deployment. Now the book didn't come about for a while. We didn't go there with the photography and the book in mind by any means. We had a mission to accomplish, but in the last couple months, after we'd been there for about a year, we had the routine down and. Actually, we're thinking about ready to go home. And then we started thinking about the book. And, of course, Joe had his cameras going most of the time just because he likes taking pictures. And he got me involved since previously, civilian-wise, we worked a little bit on some photo jobs. I do photography on the side also. And we thought maybe we'd just take a picture of a couple convoys and just take some pictures. Well, when we got Ben Buchholz involved, he's got some good vision. And he's wrote some other items too, and he thought we could do more than just a photography tour of a convoy. He wanted to do more. So once he got involved, he really took off with it and had Joe and I running. So in the last little bit while we were there.
Never any security issues with what you can take pictures of?
Yes, there is. We worked hard to make sure we didn't have to take pictures of something we weren't supposed to. So that was always a concern. Can we take a pictures of this? Or a lot of time guard towers and whatnot. And some pictures we had to throw out and we just couldn't use. So yes, there were security issues. There's signs all over that says no pictures of this or no pictures of that. So
there's this has to be the most photographed and recorded war in history, though.
I would imagine, because pretty much every soldier there took a camera with them, of, you know, the small pocket type.
The digital thing that you can immediately send it around the world.
Exactly. And so that those images went out fast, and the digital is amazing.
And you include emails in the book as well, which is, again, a different element than, you know, contact with families back home and so on. What about the choice that's made in this book, both in terms of the writing and in the photos, not to show bloody, graphic, horrible images the way we see every night on the news when, you know, you talk about the IEDs and you talk about the three lost men, but the I don't think, unless I missed it, that there's any image that just sort of turns your stomach or makes you feel that hit in the gut feeling about war.
Well, primarily there, more than a choice, is just the fact that we weren't there as photographers. Nathan was a platoon leader and I was a squad leader, and our mission and our soldiers came first. So during those times, we were doing our jobs as Army leaders, and we were just showing off one of my cameras a little while ago how beat up it was, because if something was going on, the camera that would be sitting in my lap would just be thrown behind the radio or in the back of the truck or something. So mainly we just don't have those type of the photos, and fortunately we weren't really exposed to a whole lot of things like that. So in that way, we're actually pretty fortunate. And then finally, I don't think we wanted the book to be about that. We wanted to be about the soldiers' daily lives and how they lived, what they did when they weren't on mission, and what their missions looked like.
And what makes it especially a Wisconsin book, other than I saw some Green Bay Packer shirts and a few things. But for you, if you're trying to imagine a book like this, but instead of private soldiers a year in Iraq with a Wisconsin National Guard unit, it was a California one or a New York one. What makes this especially Wisconsin?
Well, it's the Wisconsin National Guard. I guess I can't officially say every person in the book, because we did have some fillers from other states too. But a lot of people that we talk to that have seen the book, they point out people that they know. And it's just about, in this case, one unit. But it's what the mission the unit did. A lot of other units did or did a similar mission too. So I'm not sure if that really points to exactly why it's a Wisconsin book.
Well, let me follow up on that a little bit and ask from a civilian viewpoint. I think a lot of the Army organization, military organization, is totally unknown to us as to what happens to a group such as the Gator Battalion from Wisconsin. Once it gets over there, it remains intact, although you say there are a few fillers in there. They work as a unit. They work together, so you know everybody, pretty much everybody in this group of 620 or so. And you're out on pretty much the same missions from a central location.
Correct. We worked out of the Camp Navistar. That's where the battalion was stationed at. And, well, we started training together in I believe it was June, when we moved up. And if we did have fillers in, they came very early. So they had a couple months during our train-up period to get into their teams and their squads and get to know the people that they'll be working with. But once we hit the ground over there and started the missions, there's always a couple-week train-up while we're there. They call it right seat rides so we can learn our job. But once we got onto the mission, it was really a small unit mission. It was a squad mission, two, maybe three trucks, which is a total of about 9 guys. So the person in charge was really generally a young sergeant, and he'd be responsible for taking these guys hundreds and hundreds of miles away, and he was the man. So there wasn't a lot of high-level oversight. Of course, the battalion and the companies organized things, but Once they left camp, they had their trucks and they were on the road.
That's kind of an American tradition, isn't it? The autonomy of the unit in the field from a central command?
Yes, I know. Well, many years we've trained that at a platoon level. So we have about 30 guys, and myself as a platoon leader had tight control of what everybody did. But over there, you get them ready and you make sure they have what they need and you wave at them and out the door they go, and you hope the reports come back, and every day you check in with them. But it's really by computers and email, and so they're on their own out there, up to from camp to camp. And so it was a tough job for the lower level leaders. They really had a lot of responsibility.
Quite a lot was made by units that we worked with and our leadership, and even units that were in charge of other Wisconsin units that had deployed before us, about this northern Midwestern work ethic. Working at Joint Force Headquarters here in Madison, we'd hear all the info coming back from other units that we'd deployed. And the leadership overseas really seems to appreciate the type of unit that comes from this part of the country. And we heard that ourselves from our hire and units that we supported while we were over there.
In the book, it says that sometimes the experience of arriving in Kuwait or in Iraq was like putting a head in the oven, the blast of hot air and sand and so on. And I would think, too, as photographers, that you must have been struck by the unique terrain that you were in. Can you say something about the area in general, the landscape?
Not much to say.
There's not flat. Much there.
And, well, down south, it was much hotter. As you go from the south part of the country up to the north, you could feel a temperature difference. And generally, the image I try to use to feel how big Iraq is from north to south is from the southern part of Illinois to northern Wisconsin. That's about the distance from north to south of Iraq. So you could go from north south up to north, and you could feel a temperature difference. And up in north, there was more hills. Around the rivers, of course, there's a couple larger rivers there. That's where all the green was. If you get away from that, it was flat and not much to see. It's rather boring, especially on your road for a number of hours.
You know, first time going up north, and the guy's excitement at seeing trees or tall grass.
We have those in Wisconsin.
Yeah, it'd been a couple of weeks since we'd seen him. We were pretty happy to see him again. But then you return to the desolate southeast corner of the country where it's all sand and rock again.
Are there some visual images that stand out? You have a section in here on the Iraqi people and some interviews and so on, but I didn't see too much of just the landscape as landscape.
There is one photo in there that shows two of our convoys passing in the south. And when you look past the convoys, there's just two colors in the background, blue from the sky and brown from the sand. And it's like someone just drew a razor blade across the horizon. Other than the trucks on the road, that's really the only thing in the photograph.
You do have a lot of the Iraqi people in the photographs. These are all the ones I can remember, pretty cheerful, friendly-looking people. How do the people vary as you go from one section of the country to another, and especially in terms of their receptivity to American troops?
Well, one part of our mission is we were really just running convoys. So we would be on the road. We weren't really in the city very much. We didn't have a chance, because of the mission, to interact with too many people. But of course, there's always people, kids and whatnot on the road asking for food, and sometimes you did have to go through towns. Most of the time, it was good to make sure it was okay. A lot of times we went through areas at night. So essentially everyone's sleeping, that's fine with us. We'll keep on moving. We don't need to be waving and smiling. We just got a mission to do.
You obviously interacted with the people enough to take these photographs, but maybe not as much as infantry who would be out.
Yeah, there's some, I guess you'd call them the landowners, that had a certain area of responsibility and they dealt with the mayors. We did have about a platoon size element, about 30 or 40 people that was helped secure right around the Navistar area. And they'd be in Safwan, which is the first city right across the border, about 20 or 30,000 people. And their job was to secure the route going through and help out the convoys. If there was flat tires or any problems, they'd be there right away. That group was able to get to know the people of that area pretty well. They could recognize people by face, and they'd know, oh, he's a troublemaker, he's just a good kid, and all that. They always go to school at such a time. So those guys got to know And then you'd hear them in the camp. They'd start speaking, you know, little phrases of Iraqi and a little bit what they'd learn on the road.
Did you have a sense of a daily life for the Iraqis that you saw? I mean, you know, again, we see so much of the disruption in the reports we get that I'm often surprised that there is a daily life, that children do go to school and people do go to the market.
I think we got a sense of it at a bit of a distance, especially in the Safwan area, because when we would run our missions to Cedar, which was about 3 hours into Iraq, we would make that run very regularly. And so you would see them, you know, day after day after day doing their thing. So we did get to see some of it, even though we didn't directly interact with them most of the time, unless we were stopped for some reason. But most of what we've seen from here and what everybody else sees, it seems to be quite a stark difference from what we saw in most of the country. The area in Safwan and most of the south of the country seemed quite a bit calmer than what we see in the news in Baghdad and Anbar province and everything like that.
And was there a moment in terms of taking a picture of an Iraqi family or a market or whatever where you felt yourself crossing over from, you know, how during war you tend to see people as us and them or east and west or whatever? Was there a moment captured in a photograph that you can think of where suddenly it's just this common humanity?
I don't know in our mission if we saw them as all that much different than us. And we saw some similarities there and obviously some cultural differences that I think taking the photographs kind of helped us see even better, because then you would have a chance to actually sit and look at what you had just driven by it at 50, 60 miles an hour. But one that kind of stands out in mind is we were in Safwan taking some photos specifically for historical purposes. We found an individual who was driving a Massey Ferguson tractor. And we all kind of took note of that. And I don't think it quite set in right away until it just suddenly clicked, hey, that's not something you'd expect to see here. So yeah, that kind of drew some common ground there.
One thing I remember on this topic is tomatoes. In all that desert, in that area that we were, I guess, closest to, we drive through all the time in that Safwan area, there was a large tomato market. Tomatoes are lots of water. I don't know. But during the times of year, you would see all these baby – I remember stopping a truck one time for just a kind of a random stop, and there's all these baby tomato plants in the back. He had a Suburban full of them, and he was just a farmer. He had to go do his job that day. And then during – I forget what part of the year, but it was melon part of the year. So on the highway, about 6 inches off the six-lane highway, there would be melon stands. And I would not have imagined that they'd be growing these crops over in this – apparently, at least visually, apparently desert. But obviously there's a lot more there than meets the eye.
Somehow with – I mean there's more moisture in this room than there is in 50 acres of that desert. But somehow they
were
able to
grow
stuff.
Do tomatoes in here, but they just don't work that well. How do you know who to trust? Are you in a position not just as photographers but as members of a convoy or the members of the Wisconsin unit? Are you in a position where you have to judge people quickly? Iraqis?
Oh, yes. And for us, as the convoy goes, we would travel throughout all Iraq. And it changed based on what area you were in. Down south, we would let cars pass us. I mean, you'd wave them by, come on. Obviously, you're always watching them. But once you get to a certain spot, as you move north, nobody passes you. But of course, they realize the unwritten rules and they don't try to pass. So it changed based on where you were. And even certain spots were tighter than others. But in the end, yes, the guys usually are always tried to assume the best, that this person's really just the farmer out to go to his field or whatever. But, you know, at 1 a.m, this car coming up at you pretty fast, you have to make a decision and you have to protect your convoy. So there was a lot of split decisions that these younger guys had to make, and they're always tough decisions. So.
And how do you cope with, I gather it's the leading cause of combat casualties, the improvised explosive devices?
Good question. There's no set way to deal with them. You did the best you can. You used the intel each day before a convoy. The convoy commander would go get an intelligence update and say, well, for this part of the route that you're going on, there was an IED here, an IED there at this time, at that time. And you'd use the past experience, say, well, we're going to be more careful in this area, or maybe we'll set up a roadblock at this area. But there's just no good way. Mostly it's the individual watching, being ever vigilant. And then, of course, all of the route clearance teams that are out there.
There are.
Oh, yes.
Almost like you would have a minesweeper.
Yes, they'd be out there
in front of you.
Not part of our unit, but they'd be more of they would own a certain area of the road, and they'd be out there 24/7 just going back and forth in this route. And
so is there a way to actually spot those things, those devices? Or do you just have to do it electronically somehow, or how?
Occasionally you can spot them, but more often than not, the first indication that there's an IED is a loud bang and a big cloud of smoke and dust. And a lot of it was it constantly changed. They'd do something, we'd figure out how they're doing it, how to combat it, and then they'd change and we'd have to adapt again. The Army would give us tools to help defeat them, and eventually they'd figure out a way to defeat those tools, and the Army'd have to give us new tools. So it was constantly changing.
And it was the way that the Wisconsin soldiers had their lives taken, correct?
Yes,
the IEDs.
All three of them.
And we will talk about them and more from the book Private Soldiers when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Al Johnson Swedish Restaurant Sister Bay, offering Door County visitors cuisine from Swedish pancakes to Scandinavian dinner specialties. Al Johnson's a Door County tradition since 1949, on the web at aljohnsons.com.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach. Our guests are Nathan Olson and Joseph Streeter, who are with the Wisconsin Army National Guard. They provided photos for the new book, Private Soldiers, A Year in Iraq with a Wisconsin National Guard Unit. The text is by Benjamin Buchholz. We hear often about units headed for Iraq, and I suppose all of us civilians who see those stories wonder what it must feel like when you first hear where we're going over to Iraq. What was it like for you? What were your thoughts before you went over? And how did it compare with your experience once you got there?
Well, the initial call-up for myself, and I'd hazard to say most of the battalion was, they were expecting it. Not maybe exactly a certain date, but many other of the nation's guard units were being called up previously. Many of Wisconsin's guard units and guard members have been over there and were serving. So essentially, I think many of the guys were waiting for their turn and waiting for that phone call. I know myself, I wasn't surprised. Kind of waiting for it. And how about you, Joe?
Well, fortunately or unfortunately, I get a little more info than I probably should working at state headquarters from time to time. So surprise definitely wasn't the word, but it was quite the range of emotions, anywhere from kind of excited, you know, going, I guess, on an adventure, for lack of a better term, some relief now, finally know it's coming, know what we're going to do, and then maybe even a little bit of, you know, the fear of the unknown. You know, I had always been told, be careful what you wish for. Having watched one of our sister battalions already deploy, and we're currently over there, and other friends, and in particular, in 2003, a girl I was dating at the time deployed, while I stayed back and watched. So now it was kind of like now it's my turn. Now I get to go.
I guess one thing I was aware of, you know, having students that I teach at UW, was the youth of some of the people that are going over. And I guess some of that came up in photographs in this book, with just what people would have around their own bunks, or somebody who'd never had to take care of his room before. His mother had always cleaned it up, and so he's a mess, or just different things that testify to the youth of some of the people serving.
I know in my case, in particular, being a squad leader, a little closer to some of the younger kids, I think in the last year or so before the deployment, the average age of my squad dropped significantly. We kind of looked around and took stock of what we had at Camp Shelby, and talking to a couple of my NCOs, we realized that most of this squad hasn't even been to an annual training before. In fact, one of my soldiers got his alert order while he was still going through basic training and AIT down in Fort Benning, Georgia. His drill sergeants pulled him aside and told him he was going to war. So it was almost kind of a shock at first to realize that, wow, we're taking some kids. But I don't know. Maybe it it worked out better because we didn't have to unlearn any bad habits. But I've said a bunch of times, it sounds kind of cliche, but I think we really did have a chance to watch boys turn into men over there.
Is it a kind of a push-pull situation? I mean, in a way, you have people who are in the military, and unless they're in it purely for just to make some money or get some, you know, training, they tend to thrive on a certain amount of action and excitement or not. I mean, is it a problem that people would go over there and just get bored doing the same thing month after month in this rather tedious landscape? I mean, do you actually want something to happen?
Well, you don't want that something to happen, meaning, you know, things blowing up. But our unit's an infantry unit, and traditionally infantrymen are kind of rambunctious, and they will be in trouble and get in trouble if they don't have much to do. I'm glad that we had this mission compared to other missions that we could have received because the guys were busy. I know I had one soldier who would volunteer to go on missions because he had no desire to sit around a tent and do nothing. So he would always raise his hand, I'll go on another one, that's fine, or give a guy a day off or whatnot. So I think many guys were happy to go out and get on the road. Of course, they'd like their day off or two when we could get it for them, no doubt about that. But you get too many days off, and these young guys, of course, they start getting in trouble, and, well, they have a certain amount of energy, and that will come out at some point.
Energy and creativity.
And creativity, yes.
You talk about various pranks and ways that humor come out.
Yes, each unit has their set of pranksters. In our company, it happened to be our fourth platoon, and the whole platoon would play pranks on each other endlessly. Some of the things they would do, they would bring in sandbags. Well, a person was on leave, so this person would be home for 2 weeks. Well, his squad or whatnot would fill his bunk with sandbags or tie it upside down. Everything in his bunk area would be upside down, somehow taped, glued, something, just to mess with him. And that's essentially a stress reliever for a lot of guys, too.
In the military, people are supposed to be, for the most part, functioning as one unit, wearing the same kind of uniforms and so on, what are some of the ways that you captured individuality in the way soldiers would express themselves in terms of what kind of pictures they had, what sort of things? I mean, you have images of specific individual soldiers and their living quarters and some of the other things. I'm curious if there were ways that things that jumped out at you when you were photographing specific people.
I think that was mostly Ben. He shot the photographs for the individual interviews.
Ben Buchholz,
yes.
who provided the text for this book.
And he's the one that kind of got into the personal areas and into the individuals' lives and everything. And in all the interviews, I think he did an amazing job in capturing who the individual was and using his questions to bring those things out and the images of their areas and everything. I think we were more documentarians than actually trying to show the individuals.
Yeah. I'm not sure if there was too much individual time for anybody. We've definitely had it better than previous wars. I see Vietnam footage and whatnot. Of course, they lived in larger tents or many more people in one area. The tents we lived in, we had about 8 people per tent. And there, even though that's better than previous, there's not much individual time there. And then when you're on the road, you're with these people literally 24/7, at least, you know, a team of 3. And there's nothing to do but talk and share stories. And after a while, you've said all your stories. And so there's not much individual time there.
I guess I was struck by just, you know, there's some images that I guess it was Ben then that chose to include that would just show, a tiny picture of someone's girlfriend or something from home from a child or little scraps of things that would identify that person's place of sleeping, even if it's a very small space.
True. Yeah, we had pretty much a bunk would be on one side of your area. And a lot of guys had carpet in their tent. They'd get carpet from a local shop that we were able to get to. And then the other side of the area many times was a standing locker. And that was where the guys could, anything they got from home. A lot of guys would have things up from school groups from their hometown or whatnot.
Overall, being so connected, and again, in contrast to other wars, being so connected via, you know, the internet and I suppose cell phones and everything else, being so connected to the rest of the world and the home front, Is it all good, or are there disadvantages to being so connected?
Well, mostly it's good, 90%. Of course, there's sometimes when in the area we were in Kuwait, where our home base was, we could have cell phones. There was enough service in the Kuwait area. We could have cell phones. And sometimes the guy would come out for his mission and he would be a wreck because he just talked to his family or he just talked to a girlfriend and things weren't going well. And it was a direct result of him maybe being up all night on the phone. And in a way, it's great, the communications, but he's got a pretty important mission to do every day, whether driving a truck or being a leader or whatever it is. And sometimes it's hard to focus when you're so connected back home and you can hear all the details, and it gets tough. So, I mean, it's great that you can call back and help solve some problems, but sometimes you just can't because obviously you're a world away.
What about the fact that everybody pretty much in the unit is from Wisconsin? Advantages, disadvantages? Run out of stories to tell, you said, as it is. But if everybody's from the same place, you must run out even sooner.
Although the stories get retold again and again after
it doesn't
a while.
Matter.
The fish gets bigger, the buck gets larger.
Well, I've been to that lake, and there's no such fish in that place. You're lying. So,
but, I mean, does it then really help your morale that you're all from Wisconsin?
Well, I think it brings us closer because a lot of us have worked together for years. I know my platoon sergeant and I mean, we've been in the same unit for 15 years. Now, we haven't worked directly together, but we know each other very well.
That is a long time, isn't it, in military
terms? Very long time in military terms. So, you know, very classically, I can see him walk through the walking at night, and I know who it is without seeing anything. So you understand the voice from a very long distance or just a mannerism, and that's how it was with most people's.
Even Nathan and I have been together almost 13 years now. When it was Private Streeter, it was Corporal Olson back then. So yep. There's really something to be said for you know, having guys together that long and then going and doing the things that we have to do.
And are you aware, sort of, do you feel aware as a battalion of the history of it, the fact that it goes back, what, there's Civil War times with this battalion and so on? Does that matter, the history of it?
It matters, and I think it matters more as I get older. I tried to get some of my younger guys in some of the history, and I'm like, okay, sir, what do you need? And so as I age, I know when I was younger, okay, history, Red Arrow, all right. But it means more, and I try to get my guys kind of up to speed on what the history is, and so it is important.
Quite a number of Civil War battles to the credit of the organization.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Major ones.
One of my team leaders and I are both kind of history buffs, and I don't even come close to his history knowledge. But when we were getting ready to go up for the first time, we were kind of dragging a little bit from the heat. We hadn't quite adjusted to the 135 degrees yet. And I said, you know, Jeff, this would be the first combat mission for this battalion since World War II. And he kind of sunk in a little bit, and he puffed out his chest a little bit, and I think we have a little more spring in our steps after that. But yeah, there's some soldiers in the battalion that are very, very aware of the history of this battalion and this brigade and the division that preceded it.
Let me ask you a perhaps touchy question having to do with what you just said, Joe, and that has to do with the need, the possible need for an army, a military, actually to be engaged from time to time or lose its edge?
Well, there you learn a lot. When you're there doing that mission, no matter what kind of training you go through, I mean, obviously we trained up to the best of our ability for the last decade, but once you get there, that you learn so much more. In fact, we did a little different mission. We trained on a quote-unquote infantry mission for the whole time I was in. Well, now we have a different mission we're actually going to war with, a convoy mission. I mean, we're still out in a bad area, so we have to use different skills, use new equipment, and we would be getting new equipment all the time. So whether we used it in training, we were getting new equipment constantly, and we're always learning about something new, and you can never really rest that way.
I know from the time that I enlisted in the mid-90s, those of us that were new or perhaps even been around a while but hadn't gone anywhere, we always looked up to the Vietnam vets and the Desert Storm vets that were still in. And You know, they were kind of the ones that provided our way. And even ramping up to the deployment, we had some soldiers with us. A fellow squad leader of mine had been in Iraq shortly after the invasion, and he was one that many of us kind of looked to for advice and information. So there is something to, you know, have the old crusty, battle-hardened veteran around. But I don't know. I don't think you go and look to give an army that
to get the practice.
Right, right.
And
it's,
you had some family members, too, within the battalion, right? Like brothers and so on?
Yes, we had, I'm going to say several, just round numbers, father and son groups, or I guess couples. I believe we had cousins, we had a couple twin brothers. And so, yeah, there were some definitely very close family ties.
His platoon sergeant and my platoon leader were brothers.
Yep. And most of the time, some wanted to be on the missions with each other. They wanted to go out with their brother or whatever, and others like, no, I'm not going out with my brother, not doing it. So.
And what would be the reason for that? Just the fact that it would be risky to have the two
exactly.
of them together?
Exactly. Mom wouldn't be able to deal with it if something happened to both of us. So, but it was a matter of opinion. I know my platoon sergeant and another PL, they would, yeah, let's go, brother. We're out there, and they were motivated that way. But others...
This is an all-male organization?
Correct.
2nd Battalion.
Yeah, infantry units, so yeah, all males. But now we would escort transportation units. So transportation units would have females in it, so we'd be out there with them.
Are there any limitations to the roles that female troops would have in Iraq? Or are they just totally interchangeable?
Well...
I don't think we really saw one way or another because we just simply
didn't have any. Maybe from what you had seen.
But what we did see with the transportation soldiers, at least, about the only thing that I think we could probably speak to is the female soldiers did the same things that the male soldiers did. There really wasn't any difference there.
We'll look more at the experiences of the Wisconsin 2nd Battalion of the Wisconsin Army National Guard, the 2/127th, and in particular two photographers who are with us. We'll have a closer look at their experiences in Iraq right after this. This is University of the Air, and you're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio.
WPR.org features live audio, archived audio, program host bios, interviews, news, ways to contact your favorite hosts, and the WPR Radio Store, available anytime at WPR.org.
Since August of 2005, the battalion has executed more than 3,300 combat missions while driving over 3.53 million miles on the highways and roads of Iraq. All of this has been accomplished under austere and often adverse conditions. To date, over 180 of our soldiers have been presented with a combat infantry badge, combat action badge, or combat medical badge. These prestigious badges are earned by soldiers that have been involved in IED or small arms fire attacks while on convoy missions. Prior to the current deployment of Red Arrow Brigade soldiers to Iraq and Kuwait, the last time Red Arrow soldiers wore combat patches and badges was following the Second World War. That's from an update letter sent home to families from the battalion commander in March of 2006. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guests are Joseph Streeter and Nathan Olson, photographers who, along with Benjamin Buchholz, put together Private Soldiers, A Year in Iraq with a Wisconsin National Guard Unit, put out by the Wisconsin Historical Society. I should say, although you're photographers for the purpose of this book, that is not what your career is. This is just a project that developed from wanting to capture the day-to-day life of the Wisconsin National Guard Unit from the ground, really, to take advantage of the position you were in to capture what happened. They say, you know, the cliche is that a picture is worth a thousand words. And I'm wondering if there is a picture that you took. I know both of you have contributed photographs to this book. Is there a picture that you can think of where it captures something or that you're especially proud of what it shows?
Well, as putting the book together, of course, we've looked at all these images more than we'd like to talk about. But the one I like is there is a picture of a convoy. And a convoy is about 30 trucks. And in Essentially, it's the convoy's driving down a six-lane highway, just like we'd see here in any metropolitan area, and it's exiting off. And as it exits off, it takes a small turn so you can see the whole convoy and all the gun trucks and how big just the distance a 30-truck convoy takes, because, of course, they got to be spread out because you're doing 50, 60 miles an hour, and how our guys had to deal with the distance. And a lot of times our Humvees wouldn't go as fast as the semi-trucks. So there was a lot of slowing down and working as a team to keep things corralled and getting to where you need to go. So it just it's a picture that really shows very well how big and the distance and the almost a couple miles sometimes, how long these convoys would be and how to control those. And I like that one. That's what I think of when I think of our mission over there.
So. I see Joe thinking hard about one that comes to mind.
Yeah, I think it probably even taught me a lesson actually taking the photo. It's in our redeployment chapter, and essentially what I did was I stopped at the top of the stairs coming off the plane at Volk Field when we arrived at home, take a quick photo of the line of soldiers getting off in front of me and the families in the distance and the hangars at the airfield and everything. And it's important to remember that when you're standing between the better half of 324 soldiers who are trying to reunite with their families after 15 months, that you don't stop at the top of stairs with a camera and take a picture because they aren't going to stop for you.
Good way to get a footprint on your forehead.
Yeah, down the stairs you go.
You also have a photo, Joe, that you have included, I think, in that section about coming home, where it's just the welcome home troops sign on a storefront window. And there's also other ones that I think I saw that you had, Nathan, where it was the what was put on the trunk, things to remember the lost soldiers, the little memorial.
Oh, the memorial sticker?
Yes.
Yes. Yep.
You know, little visual signs and symbols of things. Are there others like that you can tell us about?
Well, I remember the other one picture we took is as we were getting ready to come home again and our replacing unit was there already. So we were starting to train up the guys who were taking us, all the for sale signs and whatnot that the soldiers would put up outside their tents or at the chow hall or in the gym and all the various places that we'd be. And the prices would slowly drop to just come and take
day
it.
Day approach.
Yep, whatever. If you stop by my tent, it's all yours.
Were there any incongruous images? In other words, there was some attempt to bring fast food out there to have things from home, you know, whether it's Subway or whatever. And were there sort of incongruous visual things where you'd see something that ought to be back in America, but there it was right in the middle of Iraq? Besides the tomatoes you mentioned that surprised you, but sort of these surprising moments, Green Bay Packers shirts. And
actually, the Packers shirt was when we were out doing a mission just to get photos for historical purposes. And we decided we're going to drive to the top of Safwan Hill. And there's a British outpost up there. So we're going to go up there, kind of see the view. And in this land of flat nothingness, here's this enormous hill. So you get a pretty good view from up there. And on the way up, we pass these two random Iraqi children just standing on the side of the road. And one of them's wearing a Green Bay Packers shirt. And I think Nathan and Ben were more concerned with where we were and where we were going,
being off
that
the
they
edge
were
of the road and into some gully to be lost forever.
They were handling the vehicle while I was sticking out the top with a camera. So I don't think they quite noticed till we came back down. But that was kind of a surprising photo to pick up.
Were there any images that you say, "Gosh, I wish I'd had the camera for that one"?
Plenty of them.
Yeah, you can't remember them all. You have to forget them, or you'd kick yourself every day. Oh, even just a little point and shoot would have been very nice to stick out the window or something. But
and we even had an idea to try to stage one, because there was an IP station, Iraqi police station, along the way, and it was probably about halfway to Cedar.
Generally.
And you would see these all these Iraqi trucks, just commercial traffic, pull over on the side of the road, and they would sleep there and stop for their tea and whatever else they were doing right next to this police station. And it was literally on the road. They would just pull the trucks over, and they would be on the traffic side of the trucks with their rugs out and everything. And here comes a convoy sailing by at 50, 60 miles an hour. You would think someone would be insane to do that here, but it was just commonplace to them. And so we had talked about this several times, how we thought it'd be so neat to stop and actually set up so that when the convoy goes by, it's blurred, but we keep the guys on the side of the road,
yeah,
and the trucks sharp.
Without us getting hit in the process.
They would
be right on the road.
So we finally got this opportunity. We're out as a fourth truck on a mission, and so we went ahead and we set up, and the lighting wasn't exactly what we needed to do this. And after all this talk and all this kind of planning and everything and racing ahead to get there, it didn't work at all.
Yeah, they had like four people and they're all spread out. But, you know, on any other day, there was a line of semi-trucks, and we called their kitchen, their utility box on their trailer. And literally they'd pull their tea set out and they'd all sit around in a rug and trucks whizzing by them, a couple of feet from them. I don't know why they didn't go on the other side of their truck in the ditch.
You do have a picture in here of these, I guess they're contract drivers sitting on a blanket between trucks with their hookah set up.
When they were in camp or when they were stopped in between travels there, they couldn't go anywhere on any camps. They were bound to their vehicles. That's where all their food was. And they couldn't go to a chow hall or anything like the soldier could. So they would have their groups, of course, and they would sit down and make a little of the best of it right there in between the trucks.
I guess one of the purposes of your unit was to defend convoys from hijackings. Hijackings, I guess, had been a kind of a big problem. The prizes were too big to resist for some Iraqis.
Correct. As soon as we crossed the border, we're in the city of Safwan. And our biggest dilemma there was the hijackings. And this truck is full of either water or food or Gatorade. And the truck itself, of course, is worth something. You know, it wasn't a militia kind of thing. It was just the local mob boss or mafia, I don't know, whatever it is, crime boss. He'd say, go get me a truck. And I don't know where they'd sell it at. I didn't see the end of it. And you would think that it wouldn't happen, but there was a lot of gravel pits and whatnot. And they'd get in there, and they knew how to drive these trucks, and you'd lose them. And we didn't really have any air support there because we didn't have much action. So we didn't have a need for helicopters to actually go track them. So you could lose them once in a while. They'd jump right up, pull the driver out, or sometimes the driver was in on it. And he'd just, at a certain corner, he'd just go straight. And since there's 30 trucks, it's hard to tell that right away. So by the time you figure it out, you might have lost them. So that was the big concern, right? Immediately as you cross the border.
I wanted to ask you about the photo that was included on the cover, which is yours, Nathan, right?
Yes.
Has Staff Sergeant David Hottenstein lowering the flag to half-mast. And it's a very unusual angle. I was wondering if you can describe, obviously this is radio, if you can describe that photo and why that becomes the image on the front for a book called Private Soldiers.
Well, when we took it, we weren't thinking much about cover images, but we've seen them doing a flag detail, and you know, officially I should have been saluting. But the photographer and me came out, and we said, well, we're going to – it was literally on a roof flagpole. Essentially, they tied it to the building as much as they could secure it. And I was on the roof looking down at them because I thought, hey, that's a –
flag's eye view.
Correct, yeah. Correct. And then only later did we really look at it again and say, wow, that's – really kind of a powerful image.
And can you describe it? What makes it a wow? What is it we see when we look at this photo?
One thing we see that we really liked is we do see the unit patch, not literally a red arrow, but our unit patch. So it identifies us as what unit this is, the red arrow, the 32nd Brigade. And then just everyone can associate the raising and lowering of a flag and the respect for that, the respect in, that the soldiers hold for that too.
How long was the 2nd Battalion in Iraq then? I mean, the book says a year, but...
Quite literally.
It was literally a year.
I think maybe one company was 364 days compared to 365, but...
Was that what you expected going in?
Yes. As we went in, we had all the guys prep. We're going to be here 1 year. Don't expect anything less. No matter what the rumors say, expect...
And you had a replacement unit?
Correct. And actually, the unit that replaced us came out of Wisconsin also, another National Guard unit. I think that's kind of odd.
Yeah, I don't think that was quite something that the Army's used to. But Nathan mentioned the rumors, and earlier we talked about people with time on their hands and too much creative energy. Several soldiers decided it would be entertaining to start rumors around the camp. Hey, did you hear? We're going home in March instead of August. Actually, it started we're going home in July instead of August, and then through the telephone game, by the time the rumors came back to him, we're going home in March, we're going home in February. Yeah. You guys really need to stop that.
That could get painful.
So most of us, I think, took it for what it was, like, hey, you know, knock it off. But somewhere there's a private on the edge who's going, what do you mean we're not going home in February? So
when you got the word that you were indeed coming back after a year, what were your thoughts?
Well, I think we were pretty well aware for a while that we were going to be coming home at a year. So there wasn't a whole lot of surprise or relief at that. But 1st Battalion, the 121 Field Artillery, received a hero's welcome when they came on the Camp Navistar. We had heard they were in country. We had heard that they were going to Camp Bearing to do the ranges that we did. But I think when those soldiers showed up and our guys saw them, I mean, it was probably about the most amazing thing that they'd seen during the tour. They're here. They're really here.
So in the buses that dropped them off were taking a bunch of our guys away. So swap seats and it was the final thing. Hey, we're done.
Joe, I know you took a lot of the pictures in the Iraq section. What image of Iraq stays in your mind of the country or the people or something that has nothing to do with the battalion itself, but just something you saw there that you'll always remember?
I think it's in the local Iraqi chapter. I shot out the side window of a Humvee, and we're probably 50-55 miles an hour, of a camel herder and his camel on the side of the road. And it was nothing more than pure luck that I actually managed to catch that within the window. But that was something that you saw every day. It was locals and their camels, and you know that's just looking at that kind of you know brings me back a little bit, you know, seeing the locals and whatnot. And for whatever reason, as long as we were there, I always found camels amusing.
Nathan,
well, there sounds odd, but their relationship. There are many sheep herders there. I mean, if they don't have a camel, they have sheep. And you'd see the trucks go by with the family in the back and a couple of sheep in the front seat of this little pickup truck. It's kind of scratch your head. Is that really how it's supposed to be? But or the small little Toyota truck and an extra cage on back and sheep stuffed in that thing. I don't know where they're going. Must be to a market or something. We didn't stop and ask, actually. But and how this herd of camels can always cross the road directly when you're going to be at the same point. So, of course, you've got to bring these 30 trucks to a really very fast stop, and you can't just do that doing this highway speeds. But, of course, they would always cross just as we're getting there. I don't think there's too many camel truck accidents, but there were some.
Well, and certainly that's that juxtaposition of two worlds.
Yes, yep. And they would see us. They had to see us coming. But they would just keep on moving, and we did our best. And you slow down and go around them,
And a camel really makes hitting a deer here in Wisconsin seem pretty insignificant. Those are some big animals. Mm.
And they're owned by somebody.
Oh, yes.
Another big difference. Yep.
It was made very clear that if we had inadvertently killed camels, that we'd be paying for them. Yep. And the prices weren't cheap.
Nope. So, yeah, we had to make sure the guys knew that it wouldn't be hitting them with an armored truck is not a...
We're not in Wisconsin anymore.
Correct.
Well, we're glad to have you back. Our guests this hour have been Nathan Olson and Joe Streeter. They're members of the Wisconsin Army National Guard's 2nd Battalion of the 127th Infantry, and they are also photographers who recorded images of the battalion's experience during its year in Iraq. And they have collaborated on a book which has just been published by the Wisconsin Historical Society Press. It's Private Soldiers, A Year in Iraq with a Wisconsin National Guard Unit. Thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
Great pleasure to meet you and hear of your experiences. I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for our next hour of University of the Air.